You know, when you talk to Armenians, they don't like to think that there was actual conflict, because they think that that somehow implicates them, that they had a role in the genocide against them. But I don't think that one ought to think that way. The fact that there is conflict and the fact that one group tries to gain some rights for themselves, as the Armenians tried to, doesn't mean that they are responsible for the genocide that is perpetrated against them. But the Armenians, for a long period of time, were trying to gain more autonomy from Turkey. They invited the European powers to speak in their behalf to Turkey. And so there was some degree of conflict and some limited degree of violence. So in many of these situations, and in many others also, there is conflict that turns protracted. Sometimes it turns what people are calling intractable, meaning that it doesn't yield to resolution over many attempts, and it is violent, and that leads to genocide. Protracted conflict doesn't always lead to genocide, but sometimes it does. Sometimes the evolution continues. And actually, when you think about prevention, and this is very important for me, you know, people who have studied genocide and conflict have been historically different realms of study. It's a little peculiar, actually, but they have been different realms of study. But you cannot prevent genocide by waiting to see that this is going to be genocide. When the evolution begins, when the conditions are present to lead to great violence, perhaps down the road, and the evolution begins, you don't know where it's going to lead to. You don't know how far it is going to evolve. You may have some guesses depending on the presence of mitigating conditions, like the presence of bystanders within that society or outside that society, to engage in some kind of action. By the way, when do we stop? We are going to 5:30. Great. Okay. I just want to have us plenty of time to talk, and we will. So, really, in order to do prevention, you have to identify the likely conditions. You have to do the kind of prevention that I am especially concerned with, which is early prevention. Not prevention when there is already large-scale violence. Many people are being killed, and then you have to engage in extreme actions and often military action. I mean, there are really a number of points. The end, often military action. Before that, when there is crisis, you can do crisis diplomacy of certain kinds, which we can talk about later. You can do sanctions of certain kinds. But real prevention for me is early prevention, when you can identify the conditions that make it likely that violence will evolve. And then you address those conditions, which doesn't require military, which is less costly, which can be done in more constructive and humane ways. So a couple more things. One of them is that, just to talk about conflict. Conflict often involves material issues. Land, water resources, other kinds of resources. Very often, it involves differences in power and status and access between groups in society. It sometimes involves issues of values to live by within a society. It can involve issues of identity. Often these things are intermixed. That is, the more powerful group, the group with more access, is one ethnicity, or one religion, or one something, And the less powerful group is another ethnicity, another religion, or other less something. And then it also becomes issues of identity. Psychological issues enter all along these ways, and they also enter because of what I said earlier. That is that each group tends to blame the other for the conflict, sees themselves as good, morally right, and the other as immoral. People have been talking about a mirror image. Both groups tend to engage in the same kind of thinking in relation to the other. Some of the issues sometimes involve issues of humiliation. That is, the less powerful group may be treated in ways that is unjust and humiliating. And that gives rise to attempts to redress the situation. And the more powerful group usually doesn't like to give up its power. But I want to tell you that, you know, we are talking here about institutions, but we are also talking here about human beings. And the more powerful group doesn't just resist giving up some of its power and influence because they are so attached to power and influence, but also because they develop a way of thinking that legitimizes their power of influence. It makes it right in their minds. We are more intelligent, we are more diligent, we have worked harder, we gained the right to be in this position in society. And so the combination of power, prestige, wealth, influence, and this way of thinking creates tremendous resistance. And often when a less privileged group begins to ask more, and the more privileged group resists, then one or the other group begins some form of violence. Violence can take the form of terrorism, it can take the form of civil rights, it can take the form of something else. And that can deteriorate. And sometimes that can move into genocide. So, for example, in Argentina, there were groups that were working for more rights for the underprivileged, for the powerless, and so on. And those in power were resisting this, and then these who were advocating for greater rights begin to engage in terrorist actions, and the response was strong violence, and then the strong violence began to expand. So people were picked up and tortured, and a large number of them killed, not just because they were fighting against the government, but because they were left-leaning. Or even people because they were advocating for the poor. This evolution that I'm talking about happens in many different ways. And one of the ways that it happens is that violence often expands from, it increases in relation to one group, and then it also expands towards other groups. So the Germans started, well, I won't go into that. I want to stop by just talking about one more thing, and that is the power of the bystander. You know, in these original studies of Darley and Latney, and my studies of helping behavior, when you set up a situation and some people are passive, it makes it more likely that other people are passive. When one person in some way attempts to influence another, it's much more likely that that other person takes action. I told you about this finding that the greater of the number of people present, the less likely that any one person takes action. And I talked to you about pluralistic ignorance, people holding a poker face, not showing that they are in distress when somebody else is in distress. Well, I did a study with the young children. I mentioned this study from kindergarten to second to fourth grade to sixth grade. In that study, I had either a child alone or two children together. be witness to a crash and sounds of distress in another room. And that's the only study in which the younger children were more likely to help when they were together in chaos. And why was that? It seemed that young children don't put on a poker face. Something happens and they start to talk to each other. And that's not surprising. You know, he was a young child and you are an 8-year-old and there's this crash and the two of you talk to each other. And as the two of you talk to each other, you just naturally join together and take action. By fourth grade, this stops. By fourth grade, the general finding that people inhibit each other's helping is present for children. In one of my studies, I told a child that if anything happens, somebody's working in the next room, if anything happens, you are in charge. A crash and sounds of distress. It doesn't increase helping by kindergartners, but increases helping by first graders. I think kindergartners are really not competent enough to take charge of the situation. But by first grade, when you are told that you are in charge, a child is more likely to help. In one of my later studies, there are two people in a room hearing sounds of distress from another room. Crash and sounds of distress. And one of them is my confederate. This is a long ago study. And when there are these sounds of distress, this confederate says one of a number of different things. One time, with some people, the confederate says, that sounds bad, maybe we should do something. Or she says, I don't know what that is. Maybe that's another experiment. I don't think it has anything to do with it. Or she says, that sounds bad. Maybe you should do something. You go in and check what it is, and I go and find the person in charge. The likelihood of the other person taking action varies, depending on what this confederate says, from about 25% of the time to 100% of the time. When this person says, that sounds bad, you go into the other room, I go and find the person in charge. Every single person goes into the other room to check out what happens. But let's go and look in the real world. Societal processes need groups of people to take action in order to make a difference. But actually sometimes a single person can make a significant difference. Has anybody heard here about the Round Rydal? You know who's Ron Rydauer? Ron Rydauer was a soldier in Vietnam. He was in basic training with the people who were at My Lai. Do you know what happened at My Lai? How many of you know what happened at My Lai? Great. Excellent. At My Lai, American troops went to My Lai, a group of villagers, in the belief that they are going to find Viet Cong there, enemy there, and they will have to fight. But they didn't find any enemy. They found old men and women and children. And they massacred them. They killed something like 500 to 600 people. Ron Rydauer wasn't there. But one of his fellow students told him about it. And this man couldn't rest until he made sure that people in the United States knew about it. He went home and told his family that he was planning to work on this. And they told him, it's not your business. Leave it. But he didn't. He wrote letters to all kinds of people until finally Mo Udall, a congressman, started hearing about it. Seymour Hersh, who was writing to the New York Times that day, picked up, wrote about it. The whole country came to know about it. Judicial proceedings. There was one person who found guilty and sentenced, and Nixon pardoned him. But the point is that by making this public and getting everybody involved with it, the likelihood that this would happen again diminished. horrible things like this happen in war. They shouldn't. It's not, war is not a justification for it. But the likelihood that this happened. Do you know who is Joe Darby? Joe Darby was a soldier in Abu Ghraib, a guard. He was on leave. He came back, and one of his fellow soldier guards gave him a disc with the famous photos from Abu Ghraib that probably you have seen of various things done to the prisoners. And Joe Darby, again, he had to do something. He consulted a couple of people, not telling them. They were creating this fictitious story about what he was asking about to get their reactions, you know, try to get some support. And then finally, he put a disc under an officer's door. And later on, he came forward to say that he was the person. And at that time, there were these things on the prisoners, not only in Abu Ghraib. There were a number of American-run prisons, U.S.-run prisons in Iraq. And we know that some of these things were happening at some of these prisons. And the likelihood of this happening decreased as a result of Joe Darby. But in Lachambeau, a village in France, a Huguenot village, where the villagers saved thousands of refugees, mostly Jewish children. There was a trial of the village doctor. And at his trial, he was explaining why he was doing what he was doing. And he inspired a German major who later influenced his superior officer not to destroy the village. At the group level, South Africa, one of the few instances that we can be pretty confident that external bystanders made a difference. People all over were demonstrating against apartheid in South Africa. And businesses finally begin to boycott South Africa as a result of these demonstrations by people. And that boycott, there was, you know, boycotts like this can have a greater influence when there is a substantial middle class in the business community that is affected. And people that were affected. And there were internal processes where businesses and corporations and so on begin to influence the government. Because they wanted to be able to function. They wanted to be able to start international business. And that contributed to the process that ended apartheid. So, I said too much. But now, let's do the rest of it together. Questions, comments, dirty, I mean, rotten tomatoes. Yes.
Yeah, hi, I'm agree. And my question to you is that it seems like since the Holocaust happened, the world is much more perceptive to the concept of genocide. But it seems that, like, also since the Holocaust happened, different genocides have received different levels of attention from academia and the international press. Why do you think it is that, like, some genocides go on, like, undercover, like what happened in Guatemala, and then other ones get a lot of attention, like what happened in Rwanda?
Well, you know, in a way, what happened in Rwanda, the attention to what happened in Rwanda may be partially a coincidence. And what I mean by that is that at the time when there was the genocide beginning in Rwanda, I'm not saying this was the only, it was at the time when Nelson Mandela was inaugurated as president in South Africa. And a lot of journalists were in South Africa. And because they were closer, and some of them made stopovers on their way home in Rwanda, they were more likely to write about it. Also, I don't know this, this is just speculation on my part, but in terms of our press, in Guatemala, we were implicated in Guatemala. the United States was implicated in Guatemala in a whole variety of ways. You know, we overthrew an elected leader. We were supporting the government in various ways and associated with the government in various ways. So I think that maybe that because we were implicated, and you know, one of the things that I wrote about in my earlier book, The Roots of Evil, is self-censorship by the media. Now there is censorship by attempt by governments to influence the media that they write less about certain things. So for example, during the Vietnam War, publications that were writing about the Vietnam War in a liberal fashion were audited by the IRS, Internal Revenue Service, trying to put pressure on them in these and other ways. But in addition to that, there is also, in spite of the fact that we are supposed to have investigative journalism and all that, there is also self-censorship by the media. And there are also fashions. So faraway places, places where we are implicated in some ways, I mean, it's funny because once attention gets paid to a place like that, the fact that we are implicated may mean that people are finding, beginning to write about these connections, and then the whole thing clears up. But I think that that may be one possible reason that people are staying away from these places. And also, you know, we have such a limited attention. I mean, the U.S. media doesn't cover international news to that great an extent. I mean, if you look at it, look at the New York Times. There are certain places that we write about quite a lot, but Sri Lanka, I mean, the violence there, especially at the end, you know, was pretty horrendous, but it got limited attention. So our national involvement, self-censorship by the media, some place having been totally out of the radar of the media because it's so far away, the people that are so different from us are some of the things. But you guys can think of more things, yes.
Hi, my name is Grant. You talk a lot about how for people to unite, people to unify, people to gain a better sense of themselves, there needs to be some sort of group unity, some sort of nationalism to help people. That you just talked about earlier, that people feel good about themselves, people feel good about the group, and that helps people as a whole. How is group competition, social competition, supposed to be avoided to the extent of forming conflict in the sense if people feel good about themselves in a nationalistic, we're better than that?
Yes. I don't actually say or think that we need to be nationalistic in order to create group cohesion and in order for people to feel good as being a member of a group. I do think that human connections are very important. I also think, as you will see later in the book, that I think that creating many possible constructive groups that people can join, especially in difficult times, when they have these needs for security, for identity, for connection, for feeling of effectiveness, that they can gain that more at times like that in groups. But that can be all kinds of groups. A group working for addressing the societal problems in a constructive way. For example, creating a constructive vision of what we want to create as a society and how we want to address our problems and how every group can be involved. Can be very positive. So creating constructive visions, actually patriotism is not a problem, which is different from nationalism. But, you know, I wrote about what I call constructive and blind patriotism. And a constructive patriot says, because I love my country, I need to look at when my country acts contrary to basic human values or even its own positive values, and then need to work to address them. So there are many different kinds of groupings in which people can gain that sense of connection, that sense of effectiveness, that sense of world that we can create together, and so on. And I don't know. Did I answer that question? I have to figure out a piece of it that maybe I'm not. Did I?
Yes, you did.
Yeah. As, I mean, by the way, just one more piece. The more different identities people have as members of groups, the less likely it may be that they join destructive ideology in difficult times. If you are a member of a constructive civic group, if you are a member, if you are a religious member of a constructive church group, if you are a member of a group that works for a better society, and so on, and so that you have a variety of identifications rather than feeling all alone at a time like that, and feeling alone, you desperately need connection, and here is this destructive leader with this destructive ideology, or here is this group conflict, and one day that you can gain that sense of connection and the fulfillment of various needs is by being gung-ho in support of your conflict. Yes.
My name is Ellie. I have a question about the difference between sort of the social context that result, context result in violent movements and those that result in non-violent movements. So like Martin Luther King Jr., Gandhi, how are those inequalities different than those that produced genocides?
You know, here is a place. One of the things about it is the leaders that make a difference. If you think of Martin Luther King, if you think of Abraham Lincoln, if you think of Nelson Mandela, these people have certain orientations, characteristics and orientations. So, for example, to go to Lincoln, when General Lee gave up his arms, he had an orchestra play Dixie, which was the song of the song. Out of respect for General Lee. And his orientation was toward reconciliation. And, you know, it's sad to think, actually, that if certain people had lived, or certain people had not become national leaders, what a different society we could be. But, so one important thing about this, is leadership. That, you know, another thing is, what are the kinds of people who are generating a particular social movement? Not the same people who generate some of the extreme right wing groups, the farmers, the militias, who are against reaffirming the superiority the rights of whites. Okay? Just this notion. Very different kind of people who would be attracted to that movement than a movement that says we need to create a more just and more equal society in order for us to move into a better future. So both the people, the leaders, the ideas, and the kind of people who join what kinds of ideas are very important.
Hi, my name is Chrissy. You mentioned the idea of the Berlin Convention, and I'm curious, especially given the current economic situation, if you think it's really realistic to expect governments to pour funds into preventing something that you don't necessarily know will happen, and then never really prove you're successful, because perhaps even without intervention, it would be unviable.
Now, it's a perfect question. It's a perfect question, because that's one of the reasons that they don't do it. They say, how do you know? For sure. Maybe this is not going to lead to violence. I posed that question, oh my God, you know, the names. There was, after the Rwandan genocide, there was a group of distinguished persons named to look at the behavior of the international community, which, if you know about it, or I think you already read about it in the book, was highly problematic. There was a meeting of this group at the Carter Center. And I asked there the
prime minister who was assassinated, Inge, I should remember the name of the Swedish prime minister.
Olof Palme.
Yes, Inge Palme.
Olof Palme.
Well, this was the wife.
Okay.
Who was at the meeting. And I asked her this very question, you know, I mean, is there any chance to activate governments? And she thought that not much of a chance. Now, this was quite some time ago, but not much of a chance because governments just are not likely to move towards something that is uncertain when they are so preoccupied with all kinds of things. But it's very short. People have done cost analysis. You know, everything that I know is overcome. Now, no, I'm beginning to know a few other things since then. But a lot of them, so we will find some of these things in overcoming evil. People have done cost analysis, not in terms of human lives, but in terms of material costs. When you prevent violence, looks like violence, engage in prevention, or any start with violence and you engage in preventive action, rather than when you later on interfere militarily in some significant way. The cost differential is huge, and that doesn't take into consideration potential human suffering and human lives. So if you can get people, governments, to think in terms of life itself, percentage of their resources that they would have to put into this kind of preventive action is so limited relative to the resources that they have to put into prevention when high-level violence already has begun, that unlike certain interests would be paid to take early action. One other point. If you take early action, even if violence had never come about, you are going to lives of people in that society. This early action involves helping people to humanize each other, creating a culture which is where respect for authority is more moderate rather than exaggerated, so that people are more able to express themselves in the public domain and contribute to the public good through participation in public conversation, where groups that may have had less opportunity to participate in public discussion now have more rights, where institutions are created that are more just, where the justice system treats people in a more similar way. So the point is that your early actions, even if they don't prevent extreme violence, was that extreme violence might not have happened, still improve the life of society to a substantial extent. Let's see. I'm just going to be sure that I don't. Okay. One more question. No, two more questions on this side, and I walk around over there. Okay.
Hi, my name is Andrew. You were mentioning just now about the international community's need to take early preventive action. Lack of action led to consequences further down the road. To what extent, in your opinion, do you think the current NATO action in Libya marks maybe a sea change for the international community? And taking early preventative action, so to speak?
Well, I consider the NATO action in Libya as a kind of mid-range action. I mean, it's not really early action. Many people in recent years have treated Colonel Gaddafi very warmly. In contact with them, Italy, extremely involved with Libya business-wide, and Gaddafi was treated as a highly respected guest in many countries. So, and he was a terrible dictator all along. So, it's not really early action, but it is action. We often don't do any kind of action. And first of all, the results seem to have been positive, right? So we can be grateful for that. I mean, we still have to see how it work themselves out, but certainly positive. Look at Bosnia, which is one other situation where that was international action. And there it was after a number of years of violence going on. We were pacifying around, there was just a little bit of military action, but very hesitant. And then after a number of years, finally, within this, incidentally, in relation to what you were saying, you know, the government, so I had a conversation at some point, relatively early in the Bosnian situation, with a member of the National Security Council. And I said to him, why doesn't the president do something? Why doesn't President Clinton do something? And he said, he can't do anything because people in Poland wouldn't support him. People who are in the countryside wouldn't support him. So there is this violence going on. It is really bad. And the supposedly most powerful person in the world, Bill Clinton, at least a representative of him, says he's powerless to do anything because the people in the United States wouldn't support him. Just an interesting aside. And now I distracted myself from what I was talking about.
Do you feel like this policy of responsibility to protect is going to gain any traction?
Oh yes, you're absolutely right, and I was talking about how in Bosnia, and finally we did something. But again, you know, in Kosovo, for example, you know, we did something, and there was a long run-up to what happened in Kosovo. So something could have been done much earlier. And then the military action was quite extensive, and it was quite destructive. Responsibility to protect is a very important principle. And so far, there is no enforcement. Right? I mean, does anybody know any enforcement mechanism? Or, you know, what activates it, and what is done, and who is going to do anything, and what? No. Do you know what responsibility to protect is? It is something that the General Assembly voted on. And governments have a responsibility to protect their own citizens, and if they don't, then the community of nations has the responsibility to protect them. Take action. And there is no enforcement mechanism. So, are they going to do things? You know, it's hard to know. It depends because there is no system of action we are moving towards. I mean, it's true that we are moving towards it with resolutions, with more action. But how it is going to unfold, like we didn't do anything in Rwanda, people think partly, at least to a large extent, because we went into Somalia and then some of our soldiers there were killed. Our government, and Bill Clinton, was very concerned that we go into Rwanda and some of our soldiers are killed and there will be this outcry against me. So, and you know, there is some improvement. Like, the United Nations used to put peacekeepers in place, not give them weapons, or even you give them weapons, not to use it in any fashion or form, not even to defend yourself. Recently, not long ago, in the Ivory Coast, United Nations troops and French troops took action in order to stop the violence there and to help stop the fighting by a president who claimed, somebody who was claiming the presidency even though he lost the election. So, there is progress, but the progress is not continuous, the progress is problematic, and again, the progress relates to taking action near the end, rather than further up.
You will have readings on the responsibility to protect, and you will have here one of the first students we ever had, Abby Williams, who headed up the long-range strategic thinking for the Secretary General of the United Nations, Kofi Annan. You will get ARP2P very extensively considered.
I'm sorry, I would like to call on you before I come over to this side.
So I would wanted to know how much of the reconciliation for Rwanda was done on a grassroots level, and how much it was, and how much of it was governmentally implemented, and on kind of a wider scope, in just conflicts in general, how much effectiveness can grassroots initiatives have versus government initiatives?
And this is just the beginning of the semester. I'm serious. I mean, these are really sophisticated questions. Now, the last part is very interesting. So if I forget it, please remind me. But you know, the charge is a government in sense, and. It was intended in part as a reconciliation process, but it is not clear that it has worked as a reconciliation process. What happens in the charter is that a particular location, once a week, meet a particular place. Everybody from the community is supposed to be there. And some places, most people are there, and some places, not quite so much. And they go through a process. The process includes witnesses describing crimes that were done in their community against people that is part of it. And then the judges, in the course of deliberation and discussion and so on, pass a sentence against people. The highest level of perpetrator as is defined in the Gacaca law, are not judged by the Gacaca. They are just very recorded. But killers, people who kill, are judged in the Gacaca. So there are 50% Tutsi and approximately 84% Hutu in the country, 1% and the witnesses are supposed to describe what happened, especially in Tutsi cases. Let's say that somebody was hit, somebody was wife was killed, or whatever, and they are supposed to describe this in front of this community that is primarily Tutsi, and that includes the relatives of the people who are living. Very challenging situation. And sometimes witnesses are harassed. There have been evacuations, which are described also in the book, that witnesses are psychologically affected, sometimes problematic ways. But when it comes to thinking about reconciliation, it's not only this situation, but also the fact that at the end of the genocide, when the Tutsi army, the rebel army, started the civil war, resumed fighting and stopped the genocide. It was already from the outside. They stopped the genocide. At the end of that fighting, at the end of that time, they also killed a substantial number of Hutus. And more tragically, when they then went to the Congo, because many of the genocidaires, the perpetrators, went to the Congo together with a very large number of Hutus who were afraid of retaliation, even though they didn't have information. When the Rwandan army went into the Congo to fight these genocidaires and continued to attack into the Rwanda, so it was a perfectly reasonable thing to go to the Congo and fight them again, the international community would. They also killed a very large number of Hutus. There is no justice process in relation and given the ideology, see, I'm talking about destructive ideologies and constructive ideologies. The Rwandan government has an ideology on the surface looks constructive. It's an ideology of unity. We all want that. But people are not supposed to talk about the Tutsis. They're not supposed to talk about the isn't an open discussion. So it's a problem with the process. But this is a governmental process. There are these other processes, the kinds of things that we are. And lately I have a counselor in the motion. We have been doing first trainings and workshops, and then we have been doing this radio conference, which now, has been going on for many years. And the radio drama, since it started in 2004, and it's still going strong, has been listened to by 90% of the population. And in there are educational elements, the politics of violence, prevention of violence, reconciliation, all kinds of things, all embedded in everything. And I have the hope, some people have been kind of theorizing that in a society, even in times of conflict and violence, latent processes can be developed, which at a later time manifest themselves. And it's just possible that our programs might be creating some culture change. Because after the first year, after 1 year of it, there were some really interesting and positive effects in terms of independence, authority, and so on. And we are not talking about attending evaluation, but it's a very difficult and challenging thing to do to evaluate a program like that when everybody in the society is doing the same. So, your last point. Governmental processes versus local processes. But, ideally, both of them. And ideally, the local processes, when they are local, happen in a way that they influence large numbers of people. And ideally, the local processes will see public. Letter writing, a very important conflict thinker, talks about top-down, bottom-up, and mid-level processes. Mid-level processes, like, for example, the media, that can influence people in the population, influence leadership. So, the more there are processes that can move from one level to another level, the more likely that there's going to be societal transformation. And the transformation involves culture. Now, one interesting case I want to mention is that supposedly in Mozambique, when things are going relatively well after a lot of violence, there weren't general societal processes, but there were a lot of local processes. And to what extent the society is doing relatively well because of those local processes, I don't know an evaluation of that. Okay. I don't mind. You can stay here.
There's a dinner with a number of us afterwards.
My name is Bradley. Long questions. You earlier discussing the theory of basic needs and process, evolutionary process of an individual who's facing difficult life situations or circumstances that then kind of frustrate basic needs and lean towards ideology, and then in that process can give in to get violence. You choose like this ideology over like moral needs, and you kind of call this a transformative learning.
Right? Along the way.
Along the way. Now, I was thinking about in Pakistan, in the madrasas, where there's individuals who don't, there's no like change. Like if that's all that they've been exposed to, are we assuming that that all humans are inherently moral, and that there is a change, and that in some situations, there's no transformation. It's just it's like brainwashing.
Now, let me just say that the evidence actually indicates, interestingly, that most terrorists don't come from madrasas. So it's not that madrasas do imbue people with religious thinking. And some madrasas do promote radical Islamic thinking with
in the rare states.
But most of them don't come from madrasas. Now, that doesn't mean that don't know everything that you are exposed to, but in the kinds of realms that we are studying, there is usually a lot of focus on institutions. There is a lot of focus on structures. They are very important. But you have to think also in terms of the human beings that are in those institutions and structures. It's people who maintain those institutions that continue to function destructively. And if you can change those people, and one of the questions is, how can we access those people? The issue of training leaders, for example, that may influence the way they see reality and what they see their possibilities are, I think is very important. So anyway, but what I'm saying is, ways of thinking is very important, and once you get involved with a group, with some kind of heretical group, that changes your way of thinking because of the way people influence each other. And then as you engage together in actions, then you justify what you are doing, and that changes your thinking. The entry point, that's a really interesting question. I am not supposed to talk about this, probably even at that move, but very rarely I get involved with something as an expert witness. I think I mentioned one of these cases in the book, that I was an expert witness for one of the people at Upper Grade. I was there was also, for example, this terrorist. And it was really, I read a lot about this person, I know about this person, I read extensive testimonies about this person, I got close to, to understanding some things about this person, and to the extent to which this person was self-radicalized was quite impressive. Now by self-radicalized, I mean this person exposing himself to imams and to people who were advocating against the West, who were advocating violence and so on. But this exposure was self-exposure. This person was not in a context where naturally this was imposed on that person. So that's very interesting. So the point that you are raising really is, what is the starting point for that kind of thinking? And what I'm saying is it can be there. Sometimes it can be in certain addresses. Sometimes it can be in certain mosques. And actually mosques have been influential. Certain mosques where there are certain features that people are in a community and talk to each other. Mosques have been influential. Sometimes you enter a room. Sometimes terrorists often enter rooms, by the way. Once it is initiated, through relatives and friends who are in the room. So the people in the room reach out to other people they know. They're going to talk about either understanding that. So there are many other things. Does this answer your question?
Well, it's more like regarding people that don't have choice in involving themselves in groups. Kind of in Nazi Germany, or like where you're kind of forced into this ideology. Is there studies of like that show? Is there like a transformative process, or is like, are there cases like where there's no like ability to discern that it's not moral because it's only been exposed to?
I see. But this is the only thing that they are exposed to. That's the only thing that you are exposed to, then that's your world. Now, I'm trying to think of cases where that was somebody the only thing that they were exposed to. I don't know. Like, there was one particular terrorist that you are mentioning in the book who was one of many siblings. This person was the only sibling in the family that became a terrorist. He was exposed to a particular teacher. who had great influence. He was also exposed to his family who were going on to that direction. So sometimes there is some kind of a match. Young American extremists who were studied by somebody named Ezekiel, very often from at an early age begin to write away and ask for Nazi literature to be sent to them. So there was something in them that connect them. Certain needs, many of these people come from very deprived backgrounds, very difficult experiences, that connect them. I totally believe that if that's the only environment that you are exposed to, and that's what you take in a sense, you don't see anything else. But you don't see other options. And I'm sure that there are many cases like that. Criteria and try to specify what kind of body first of all, let me just say, I'm not sure anger phase or what phase, but I think we are probably in agreement, she and I, that early response is very important. You know, people in the trauma field, some in the trauma field say that the nature of the trauma that develops depends both on the traumatizing experience and what happens after. You are going to have a different experience depending on what happens, in my opinion, actually, before, during, and after. I have been writing now for a number of years about what I call altruism, wound, suffering.
Cool.
Altruism, wound, suffering.
Could you mention that? You're talking this way.
I have been working for the last few years, I've been writing and thinking about what I call altruism born of suffering. And I became interested in, I won't describe it because we don't have that much time in detail, quite interested in it, but anyway, I became interested by seeing some people, having evidence of some people who suffered greatly, who were victimized, and they became caring and helpful. They wanted to have people who have suffered, and they wanted to have to prevent others suffering. So there is this thing. There is no necessary route from victimization to aggressiveness. It depends. What happens as a result of victimization depends on various kinds of experiences. So let me tell you briefly what are some of the experiences that I think make a difference. The first one is, again, the issue of active bystandership. When people who are victimized are held by some people in some ways at the time of the victimization, I believe that is one potential contributor to how they come out of it, coming out of it in a more positive way. You are severely victimized, but at the same time, other people reach out to you in some way, trying to help you, trying to support you. You are more likely to not come away by seeing the world as a terrible place where everybody is evil and violent. You have some sense of the possibility of human connection, caring, and warmth. If a person has the capacity to take action in their own behalf at the time of victimization, that also contributes to altruism born of suffering, I think. It gives you a sense of empowerment. It gives you a sense that it's possible to do positive things in the world in your own behalf. And also, if you were able at a time like that, when others, you and others were victimized, to do something for others, that also contributes. So, being helped at the time, being able to do things for yourself at the time, to mitigate to some degree or help save yourself, and also doing things for others. Afterwards, to get support and caring and connection and healing. How do people heal? Well, people heal in part by being supported in an affectionate way, right? With people being healing by being able to talk about their experiences and receiving empathy and support and caring from other people. It happens in therapy, but when a group is victimized, it has to happen in a more national way. And in our radio programs in Rwanda, we provide examples of people noticing others acting in traumatized ways. Because in some societies, it's very easy for people to look at somebody who acts in that way and think that they are crazy. So part of the education is to see that people are not crazy. People were affected by their experience and they act in traumatized ways. So being able to talk about it and others responding in constructive and positive ways is extremely valuable and very important. This is, you know, a totally different kind of thing, but when people are raised caring and love, affection, and at the same time with a sense of ability to do things for themselves, that is something we can protect, though. They are affected in a different way, I think, by traumatizing experience.
Okay. So a few years ago, a few years ago, Gordon Brown said that with the internet and YouTube, that another Rwanda can never happen. And I think that's a pretty optimistic statement. But I was wondering if you could talk about sort of the role of information and with new technology, the effect that will have both on the international community and within the conflict itself.
Now, we know clearly that our new medium is able to activate people for positive lifestyle. People can initiate social movements, they have spring, and so on, and all kinds of positive actions. We also know that the media can activate negative actions. When I talk about active bystanders, just as a matter of language, I refer to active positive bystanders. But of course, there is active negative bystanders. Right? And we do know that there is a lot of media out there that incites people to courage. And some of it is effective. Well, that's one of the ways that people get involved, by the way, by getting engaged with media. And they may engage with media for social purposes. They may not select it out because they want to be terrorists, and so I want to get engaged with media that will help me become a terrorist. They may engage for social purposes, but as part of those social purposes, that is all the other stuff that so happens on that website, and then they begin the process of transformation. So, yes, I mean, we live in a different world where people can come together and create each other, and it's different, definitely, from what used to be, that something is going on in society. The government has censorship and influences everything that is published in the newspapers, in authoritarian and autocratic societies, and people don't really know. And it makes it that much easier to go into a state of not knowing. So not only do you close your eyes, but there is no information. So if you have any inclination to not really wanting to engage, very easy. That's more difficult. That's definitely the case. But the influences can be very specialized. So actually, one of the questions you have to ask is, how can one strengthen people's engagement with positive influence, and how one can kind of work in this new media realm to limit the power of the media of men. I'm posing these questions because you are engaging in a journey, right? And so we are together in this journey, and you are agents in this journey, and you can address some of these questions.
You talked before about the Guatemala genocide. Very much recognized because we had some affiliation with Guatemala, and
army that killed
the other group, 20,000. I mean, it was, they were poor, and what happened was Mugabe actually had support from many people in the south, and 20,000 the valley people in the south, which is actually not been already used on the way, but it was massacre.
What I know about this is just for by the way, just to clarify this point, I know about a lot of genocides, but my work is, I'm not a historian, so my job, as I see, that my purpose is not to look at every genocide, but it is to understand how these things come about and how we can prevent them. So, you know, like, there is this huge book by Ben Kiernan. You know, I think I called his name yet. You know, he's a genocide scholar here. His original work was in Cambodian genocide. Blood and something is the title of the book. And he reviews every genocide in existence. Ancient history. He's a historian. He wants to lay out his genocides. I know a lot of genocides, but that now my work has been, how can you understand that? How can you understand the source of it? I want to study enough of it that I can understand the general pattern and also to understand how we can do prevention and everything.
Hi, I'm Conrad. So your book mentions that the devaluation of a group of people, the us versus them mentality, and past violence and oppression all lead to mass violence and genocide. So looking back at the treatment of African Americans in this country, whether it was slavery or Jim Crow laws, why, and all these factors were present, you know, like devaluation, us versus them, and all that was present. So how was mass violence avoided then? What were some key factors?
How was mass violence avoided against Native Americans?
No, African Americans. Talking about because these factors were present, like devaluation, us versus them. So, what were some key factors why mass violence was avoided?
One thing that you can say about this group was so subordinate and used for economic purposes that there was no reason. They weren't big ideological enemies. They were simply profoundly developed, looked at as less human, and they were used. And so, not being enemies, not being scapegoat each other for life problems, some of these forces were not at work. The motivation, I'm always interested, what gives rise to the motivation to turn against this group and begin to kill them, and in the process, for the conditions against him to diminish. So there were this element there which explained their future. But there weren't the forces there to give rise to the motivation to kill them. And from an economic standpoint, that would have been comfortable. Was they were useful. Now, if you ask what happened to this, but still, I mean, they were so diminished, so restricted in their way of in their life, and so on, that there wasn't a motivation.
Foster that, the people who've already created that us versus them, the otherization mentality.
Yes. question is, how do you create empathy? How do you reduce mistrust? How do you do some of these things? And one of the issues is ideology. Each side has an ideology where the other profoundly upsets the other. Some Israel has the ideology of greater Israel. Greater Israel, historical Israel, it comes out of religious context. And it includes the rest of that. So, that is that the Palestinians are in the way of the fulfillment of the second of greater Israel. And for a lot of Palestinians, there are certain Hamas, but probably not just Hamas, the world actually a world without Israel. Israel. So the ideology is a world without these people. And it was a little bit like that in the modern Bible, that the ideology was who to power was. We Hutus must have power. And the underlying, the underpinning was that the Rwanda, the Tutsis are so problematic for us that we cannot be comfortable in our power to win with it. So, one piece of this is, in my mind, to create a convincing alternative ideology. And to be able to spread this. Now, what would be a convincing alternative ideology? It can be very simple. Vision of an economic community where two countries work together for the benefit of everyone. Now, if you spread this around, it makes a lot of sense because in such a community, just the fact that it is an interconnected system reduces also the threat to Israel. So it reduces the sense of danger. And it is that mistrust that these people are dangerous to us and they want to destroy us, that's an element. So both groups would buy into such a vision. And how can you further that vision? Well, I think, for example, I believe you will see later on that trying to move towards a shared history in the sense that each group that has been in conflict or violence with each other tends to have a view of the history of it, where the other one is responsible. And as long as you say, we had all this suffering, why did we have all this suffering? It is because of the other, because of who they are and what they did to us, and each group does that. It's very difficult to have persistent peace, because there is ongoing suspicion and sense of danger. So, I write later about changing collective memories, the way you hold the situation. In fact, in Israel, there was a change. Originally, the government and the country said that 700,000 or so Palestinians who left Israel after the partition, and that was this war of independence, a number of armies came in and there was fighting, that they left because their leaders told them to leave, or because they felt it was dangerous and they left Bosnia. And new historians in Israel show that, in fact, they left for a variety of reasons. Because their leaders told them, because it was dangerous for them, because Israel forced some of them out, or in some other ways incited them to leave. Now, Palestinians have had the all of them left because Israel forced upon them. There are four studies that people have done over time. They show that Palestinians left because there was fighting in their village and they felt unsafe. So they left because their leaders told them and because they were expelled. But actually, the danger near their village and leaving because of that was a much greater percentage of said that Israel forced them on. So each collective memory, if each of them can change. If they can come closer together, that would continue to more trust, because that responsibility is going to shape that. If you look at yourself, and if you can get people to acknowledge your responsibility for how they have felt developed, there are all kinds of processes that would be necessary for them. And that's very difficult. I mean, it's amazing how difficult it is for people who have done harm, especially substantial harm, to acknowledge their role and acknowledge their responsibility. And it makes such a difference. And if you can move people towards them, and you can get communities established to work on this and look into this, and you can have societal conversations initiated. Again, like everything else, this is a social conversation.
Yes, my answer is awesome. Just what you were mentioning right now about the people trying to, I guess, have to do such harm. I guess my question was like, how these people relate to society. Like you've seen
how these
people relate to society.
Who reintegrate?
Yeah, like for example, I was thinking about the Guatemala genocide. And how many of the people that were like involved in genocide and were the perpetrators now, like after 10, 15 years of this, the civil war has ended. Many of the same people that were in charge of the genocide that are becoming like involved with the drug cartels and activity. And it seems like they just didn't have that closure or even have a territory, like a closure protection blood as opposed. They have a territory for blood as opposed. And my question is what is the effect that violence has over perpetrators and psychologically, I suppose?
Now, there are two points here. One of them is that I think violence, being violent, engaging in violence, also significantly affects perpetrators. It affects perpetrators in several ways. At the minimum, they undergo a psychological transformation, because they have to deal with what they are doing. So they devalue the other, they exclude the other from the moral realm, and so on, what I talked about. But they do this not just a societal process, individually. Also, we know that people who kill and people who do terrible things, now we know from various research that they are affected, that they are traumatized by it. Even soldiers who kill in battle. So this is legitimate, right? Supposedly. You are fighting another country, another group, you kill in battle, and even people like that are substantially affected. When soldiers engage in atrocities, that is, violence against civilians, that is not part of the fight. They are more affected. So people are greatly affected. But we are also talking about how society is affected and what society needs to do to kind of move to a better place. And there the issue of justice comes in. So one part of it is, like everybody else in a highly violent society after violence, perpetrators need to heal. They need to undergo a healing process. They need to come to the point, I think that there is this seemingly paradoxical thing that perpetrators need empathy and support before they can move to the point that they acknowledge the harm that they have done. And often, the last thing people want to do is to provide empathy and support for perpetrators. But at the same time, you also need the justice process. You cannot just have horrible things happen in the society and then go on as if nothing can happen, so that previous perpetrators are becoming going to the government, right? In Argentina, after the disappearances, the president gave amnesty to everyone. No, maybe never did this because in Argentina, several decades, civilian rule was overturned again and again by military. And people were afraid that if we take the military to account, the repelled military to account, then they're all going to give us to the government again. So this was in the late 1970s, the end of 1970s, when all that was going on. In the early 2000s, the amnesty law was changed, was overturned, and the new justice process started because people needed that, society needed it. You know, victims, the relatives of victims, the grandmothers whose children were killed and grandchildren stolen from them and given to military families needed it. And so a societal process began. So the question is how to combine these things, societal healing, including perpetrators, justice processes that are reasonable justice processes, not of a kind that again overturn the negative impact, create anger and desire for revenge. All of these have to be part of the complex. Who next?
I have a question about more talking about when you were talking at the beginning about how people walk down the street and they see someone fall down and they see someone get hit by a car and they don't even blink, hardly just keep walking. And this confused because I studied abroad in China where that is very normal. Where just walking by and acting like it's not your problem is very common in China. One day I was going to school and a little truck came and hit a bicyclist. And not one Chinese person came over. Every international person in the vicinity ran into the person, and not one Chinese person came over. And I know that they don't have a problem with victimization, and they're not like, trying to just escape something like that, but I'm just curious why that is.
I can't answer because I try to be a responsible scientist. And when I answer things, I study the culture, I study the situation, and try to make sense of this in terms of my studies. And I know a little about China in this way, but I have to tell you that I have a same experience, and in some ways even worse in China. There were two people who were, one of them had a woman and a man using a hope or something, going off this other man, getting his hook into him and doing things to him and collapse on the ground, and there was a crowd standing around there, they weren't doing anything, and I and my partner were running around like crazy. I woke up saying, do something, call the police, please. We finally called someone who spoke English. He said, please call the police, do something. And we were also shouting at the people, here's what they didn't mention. And the people who called said, you know, basically this is all the example. And they did call the police, but the police never came, obviously. So it's not why this is, you really have to, you know, you can't, in order to understand these things, you cannot understand. See, I believe that we have general principles that need to apply to particular circumstances. But I don't know the circumstances. You have to know the circumstances. You have to understand the culture. You have to understand what is it, what was the history, the course of which I think people felt the need not to engage, not to intervene in a way. Was it ritual authority? That authority was so powerful that only people with authority were supposed to engage in a situation like that? Was it that there was always so much danger that get involved with anything that is dangerous? And so you better keep away from everything and not generalize.